Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, you've made the interesting choice to listen to the following episode of The Roadbook, part of the Never Strays Far family of podcasts that don't always talk just about road racing all the time, so sorry about that. Anyway, here are the latest musings from David Miller in Girona and me, Ned Bolting, in Lewisham, God's own London borough. But first, we go back to Italy. Roglic then back at the Madonna di San Luca in Bologna. He takes the Giro dell'Emilia. Fuglsang gives up, Moscon can do nothing, and Roglic makes it 2 out of 2 in Italy. He takes Tre Valli Varesine, and he is on some form. Alvarez is now there, and he's on his wheel, but he's left it too late, and Michael Woods takes the win. Brilliant from Egan Bernal, the winner of the Tour de France, unstoppable on the final climb to Gran Piemonte. Bauke Mollema knows that finally now he has become a monument man. He takes Lombardia, the race of the falling leaves. Mollema, the winner on the banks of Lake Como. And this is our second take of recording the podcast, David. In the interests of being, you know, full disclosure here, I just screwed up our first take by misnaming the year that has just finished. I thought it was 2018, but it's not. 2019 has just come to an end, basically, with Lombardy and with Paris-Tours the following day. That's it.
But that's, you know what, that's exactly what it's like. And that essentially sums up what Lombardia represents. Although, yes, there's Paris-Tours the next day, and then there's the race in China and some other little things going on. It's like the few days after New Year's Eve, January the 1st, where everyone keeps getting the New Year wrong. It already exactly. Feels like it's next year. And yet
exactly,
we're still in
exactly, 2019. Exactly. That's so right. And you start to refer to the Tour de France this year. You instinctively start to talk about last year's Tour de France, don't you?
Instinctively.
Yeah, so listen, this podcast, we are going to focus big time on what's just happened in Paris, just about an hour or so ago at the Palais des Congrès, which I'm sure you've attended on many occasions, and I have on many occasions as well, when they reveal the route of the tour, and there's plenty to concentrate on there and to look forward to as well. It's really interesting, I think. But before we get to that point, David, because we have given them a lot of attention this year. The Italian races, they came to a close, didn't they? We talked about most of them, but they came to a big shuddering close with a very, very fine win by Bauke Mollema, Malcolm Bollema. Did you get to see much of it or not?
Sadly not. I was travelling what felt like all weekend because I was away. I had a trip to do, so I missed everything. I even missed the sub 2 hour marathon. I was watching.
Oh yeah, of course.
On my phone as I was travelling. It was a bit of a sporty weekend. There was so much going on, but yeah, as you said, Malcolm Bollema, as you christened him a while ago, that tends to have stuck. Which, out of respect for a monument winner, Bauke Mollema, from what I saw, was an absolutely stellar ride, because I just caught on, because again, as I said, my traveling, I came back online coming off a flight and then was looking, and then I was seeing all these attacks from Roglic, from Valverde. You had all the usual suspects up there, but I'd come on just at a point where I'd missed a bit of news that Mollema was ahead.
Yeah,
so it was amazing to see these absolute stars of cycling, the current ones, and obviously Valverde, who's been around for about 250 years, attacking the hell out of it, and actually in front, a minute ahead, was Bauke Mollema. So, you know what, yeah. If you're going to do it that way.
And that is the Mollema way now, isn't it? I mean, if you sort of rewind a few years ago, he was one of those riders who, you know, perhaps hung on to his GC ambitions for a little bit longer than perhaps, you know, was with hindsight he should have done. And so he's kind of reinvented himself, if you like, as a one day racer, but as a breakaway rider in stage races. And we've seen that on the Tour de France and at the Vuelta. And it was great to see him. Oh, this is his biggest win. I mean, but he and his best to date. And David, he does that thing that I think people consistently, or the opposition on this occasion, underestimated in him again. He does that thing that you once said to me about Dan Martin. You said the thing about Dan is Dan knows how to go really deep. He knows how to suffer, and he kind of brings it on himself. And I often think that Mollema's a bit like that. I mean, It's just, there's no, so, you know, when Gilbert wins great races like this, there is so much tactical play and ebb and flow and holding bits of energy back and reserving things because he understands and he plays with the opposition. With Mollema, it's just kind of balls out, isn't it? And that's how he does it.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, that's, yeah, and Dan Martin's similar. They're tactically astute, but they know they've only got one bullet to fire. And when they go, it's full commitment. And it's, as you said, with Philippe Gilbert and many of the let's say, consistent, regular monument winners, they're very savvy. And you always get the impression that they're playing off the riders like Mollema and Dan Martin, anticipating their move and then getting their win in a much more wily way. Whereas Mollema, and there are a few other riders like him, when they go, you know they're all in. And Mollema, it's not only the fact that he looks like it. His style on the bike is unique, let's say, but yeah, highly effective. And the way he raced on Sunday, it's rare for anybody to win one of those hilly classics, because that's what Lombardy is, in that fashion, because I don't think anybody can truly understand how hard those races are. Not only the way it's raced and the field and the length, but the actual terrain. It's most people consider to be mountains, to be honest with you, if you're riding them. Liège, Bastogne, Liège and Lombardia. And so to do what he did, and with all those attacking riders behind him, I think he's the type of rider that the whole peloton will be pleased for. He's such a nice guy, and he's almost never quite, and these things happen. So for that to happen, I think it's well-deserved, and it will be universal, just respect and happiness for him.
Hear, 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 David. Listen, I was going to just ask you about, because I am, obviously, with the road book, as soon as Guangxi is done, we print the road book, and I am busily, not me directly, but our team are busily getting in all the votes from the jury, who contain the likes of Marion Rousse-Galopin, and Orla Chenoui has been invited this year. Rolf Sorensen has joined us. You're part of it. Ryder Hejdal is. Phil Liggett is. Christian Prudhomme. So a whole bunch of... Sean Kelly has voted as well. So prestigious jury. And we're just pooling their various different votes. So I can't tell you, even though I know, who has won each of the six categories, David. But we can probably reveal who you voted for. And it'd be interesting maybe to get your justification for that. So if I go through the categories, let's start with the combativity awards for both male and female riders. In the female category, I was responsible for the nominations, I have to say, but although all of you guys could have voted for someone else who I hadn't thought of. But Soraya Paladin, Anna van der Breggen, Amanda Spratt, Lizzie Deignan, Christina Majeros and Annemiek van Vleuten were my nominees. And who did you vote for there?
I went for Lizzie Deignan as number one, because I think on more than just the racing, coming back and fighting back to fitness from having Orla, her baby girl, her and Phil Deignan's baby girl, I think, and the way she then raced, she didn't race conservatively. She came all guns blazing. And for me, she's my combative female rider of the year, followed by Amanda Spratt and then Annemiek van Vleuten. She got a third simply for that incredibly ridiculous world championship ride.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Very hard to argue. And Amanda Spratt is just one of those riders who's always combative.
She's always there, isn't she?
She's always there. Do you remember how close it was in the La Course, that great race into Pau, when Marianne Vos just caught her in the line the last 600-700 metres?
She won it last year.
That's Amanda Spratt. Was it last year or the year before? A couple of years ago. Anyway, the combative male rider of the year. Well, there were so many ridiculously good candidates here, starting with Mathieu van der Poel, Wout van Aert. I chucked Miguel Angel Lopez in into the mix simply because he does attack a lot and he punched someone at the Giro. So, you know, he's got to be in there. Mads Pedersen for that phenomenal ride. Thomas de Gendt, Philippe Gilbert and Julian Alaphilippe. And who did you go for?
I went for the second year running, Julian Alaphilippe for number one. I did Thomas de Gendt number two, simply because he is just an absolute maniac and he's always attacking. And then Miguel Angel Lopez third for just the way he races. And I think that was exemplified in particular at the Volta a España, where he was the most attacking rider, mostly in futility, but it was a pretty amazing ride.
Hear, hear. You don't need to justify your Julian Alaphilippe selection, I don't think, to anybody. Young female rider of the year. Again, some really good candidates here. The Italian Chiara Consonni. Lisa Klein has made her mark. Elisa Balsamo. Also Demi Follering. Lorena Vibes and Chloe Dygert Owen, who of course won the elite women's individual time trial in Harrogate in such style. Who did you pick there?
I went for Lorena Vibes because the way she's just, I mean, she's a sprinter, but the way she's been racing this year, I think, has been an amazing display, which we don't see happen so often in women's cycling, especially a young rider just coming in and dominating the sprinting scene. So that was amazing. Chloe Dygert, second, because just the ride she did at the Time Trial World Championships was such a standout performance, and the way she's come through the ranks in Colorado, what she was doing. So she's definitely up there. And Demi Vollering as third because, well, I think she's just a name I keep seeing, and I think she's got a great future ahead of her.
Very good. With the men, we went for the following nominations. The young men, this is. Miguel Angel Lopez, Sergio Higuita, Egan Bernal, ridiculously, won the Tour de France, young rider. Mads Pedersen, Remco Evenepoel, and Tadej Pogacar. What a list that is, by the way.
That could just be the men's rider of the year list, actually. It's that's how good this current crop are. But had to make a choice, and I went for Tadej Pogacar as the first because I don't think, even with the competition of Remco Evenepoel and Egan Bernal, I feel Tadej Pogacar he's just come from nowhere to a certain degree, although he hasn't because he's been there. But the way he raced in the Vuelta was just interstellar. Remco Evenepoel put number second because, again, I've never seen anything like him before, what he's been doing. A very different performance to Pogacar, but still madness. And then, talking of madness, Mads Pedersen, third for his world championship ride, which I think caught us all off guard and was a wonderful thing to behold, not only for him individually, but for Denmark as a whole.
So quite a lot of crossover between the young male riders and the male rider of the year. So they include Primoz Roglic in the nominations. Philippe Gilbert is there again. Sam Bennett, I chucked his name in because I think he has been the dominant sprinter, just about, in a very competitive field. Mathieu van der Poel, just simply because. Julian Alaphilippe, and have I mentioned him already? Egan Bernal, and those are the names there.
Yes, I went. This is quite pleased. I think this is a great indicator for the way the peloton is. I'd chosen most combative rider of the year, Julian Alaphilippe. He's also got men's rider of the year because I think the way he races, he's world number one, let's not forget, till August, till September. So it's not just he's attacking for nothing, he's attacking and getting results. And that's the way bike racing should be. Him number one, Mathieu van der Poel number two, just because of this breath of fresh air he brings to professional cycling and the way he raced. I mean, it's his scorecard's ridiculous. And then Primoz Roglic for third, who's really, I think, made a step function kind of increase this year. He's just proven that he now deserves the status of being one of the best Grand Tour racers in the world and a legit favourite for next year's Tour de France.
Yes, and he's going to win that, as we said the other day, didn't we? Because I've backed him, so obviously Nothing could possibly go wrong.
nothing can go wrong.
Female Rider of the Year, the nominations were Chloe Dygert Owen again, Kirsten Wild, the sprinter, Marta Bastianelli, Lorena Vibes, who at the age of 20 makes it into the Female Rider of the Year. Well, she won the World Tour standings, for heaven's sake, so of course she's there. And then two very familiar names, Marianne Vos and Annemiek van Vleuten.
Well, I went for number one, and I might be a bit biased in this one. So, I mean, all of these decisions are biased. They're a little bit subjective, although as much as we try to be objective. Marianne Vos, number one, because I think that the way she's raced this year, a couple of years ago, we thought it was almost all over for her, that perhaps she just done this wonderful younger career in her 20s, and then that would be the end of her, and she'd burnt herself out. And then she's come back this year, all guns blazing, and just proven that she is number one. Number two, Annemiek van Vleuten, a great rider of the Worlds, and just the consistency, the way we're seeing her just come up and cement her status within the women's peloton. And then I put Chloe Dygert again because I just think the way she was racing towards the end of the season, I have a feeling she's going to be sticking around for a while.
Yeah, it looks that way. She's just 22 years of age as well. Okay, excellent. Okay, so those are your choices, not the final decisions of the entire jury. You'll have to buy the roadbook, I guess, to find out. No, we'll be announcing them in a short while when they cease to be embargoed. Moving on then, David, let's have a bit of music and then let's talk France. Okay, I sent you a little link to a graphic, David, of the route all laid out side by side, every single stage. Have you had a time to glance at it yet? I know you haven't had much time to absorb what the route looks like, but have you had a look at that at least?
I have had a look at that, and it looks like an absolute... Well, I think you said the message looks like the Vuelta. It does look like the Vuelta España. There seems to be, at a brief glance, if you were to line all the 21 stages along a line and just condense it, it looks like it's relentlessly up and down. I haven't looked closely into it. I'm just looking at the map now because I think, much like everybody else, I haven't had much time yet to look at this. And it's a route that I would say is unprecedented.
Well, I mean, first things first, what really stands out when you look at it is half of France is missing. So it's been a couple of years now that we won't have been to Brittany, for example. Not since 2018 and the Mur de Bretagne. Normandy is entirely absent, as well as Picardy. So it doesn't really go north of a line, apart from Paris, obviously. But if you draw a line from La Planche des Belles Filles down to the mouth of the Gironde across France, it doesn't stray north of that. So that's really unusual, isn't it?
It's really unusual. And for people that don't know the geography so well of France, that's literally, if you were to have a map, the hexagon of France, and just draw a line through the middle, the whole race takes place underneath that. It's amazing. It's essentially the whole of the south of France is where the Tour de France will be next year. And I've never seen anything like it. And on purely personal terms, I think this is going to make our life a bit easier regards transfers, at least.
Yeah, of course, it's all about us and our transfer. Yeah, no, it kind of goes. So it goes from bottom right across to bottom left, and then it goes up again. Anyway, look, we'll go into it in a bit more detail. It starts in Nice, and it hangs around in Nice. So stage one is Nice to Nice, and stage two is Nice to Nice. There's no prologue. But straight away, David, on stage two, you're climbing, and it's not inconsiderable. I mean, there will be some sort of GC shake-up almost straight away.
Yeah, it's. I'm just looking at these things now. It's amazing. It's like straight into it, and this is something that I don't think... It's something that's becoming a little bit more on trend, let's say, at the Vuelta. But the Tour de France, to go immediately into a mountain stage on the second day, and especially at that time of year, down Nice, it's going to be El Scorchio. Yeah. That's going to be an incredibly demanding stage, and immediately we've got a GC race in our hands from stage two.
And stage four finishes... This would be my 18th tour. I can't remember anything like this. Stage four finishes on a summit in the Alps. I mean, that's just bizarre. So that's a climb I don't know, and I don't think it's ever been raced on the Tour de France before. The Ossière Merlette climb, 1850 in altitude. But it's not inconsiderable. I mean, it's a major day in the Alps.
Yeah, I mean, sister on the day before. So already know Nice to Sisteron. Sisteron is a gateway to the Alps in many ways. So we're straight in. Normally we're waiting for the second week or the third week for the Alps or the Pyrenees. And this year, stage four, we're already in there. So if we look at stage one, flat stage, stage two, mountain stage, GCs playing out, stage three, flat stage, stage four, as you say, summit finish in the Alps. And it's like, it's nuts.
Yeah. Stage six is the first of two summit finishes in the Massif Central. They are separated by 7 days of racing. So there was one on stage six and one on stage 13 that we'll come to that. They're also separated geographically. And the Massif Central is such a huge region that we're right at the south of it. We skirt it as we head towards the Pyrenees. And on stage six, there's a summit finish up the Mont. And I don't know how you pronounce this, so I'll do my best. Aigual is the best I can do at the moment. But there we go, the second summit finish on stage six. And we know what those Massif Central days can do to the race.
Normally, the Massif Central are the stages which put the most fear in the peloton, because it hasn't got that defined finish where there's so many teams with a vested interest to control it. The moment you go into the Massif Central, and the Massif Central is renowned for just being up and down all day, and not just little hills. We're talking can be 5, 6, 8K climbs, and there's generally not a meter of flat, heavy roads. And if the peloton size race from the off, you end up having sometimes uncontrollable groups of 20, 15 to 25 riders going off the front. And we've seen time and time again GC being played on stages like that. So it's not as if it's a relaxed transition stage. That, once again, will be a GC day.
Yeah. Then we've got a couple of days. We eventually get to the... we drop out of the Massif Central, and there are a couple of days in the Pyrenees, two, that don't, neither of which feature a summit finish, which is really, really unusual. We go back, however, to Larrain, where Primoz Roglic won the stage on the descent in 2018, the day before the individual time trial. I think it was stage 19, wasn't it? So that's familiar from recent years, but no summit finish in the Pyrenees. And then there's a rest day, and we transfer all the way up to the mouth of the Gironde River to the west of France. And there are a couple of opportunities there back to back for sprinters. Stage 12 is the
after that rest day, so that's stage 10 and 11. That is the first time by that point that there are two flat stages back to back.
Yeah.
So from stage 1 to 9, they're almost alternating flat hilly, flat mountain, rest day. So, I mean, this is something that we haven't seen before. Then you come out the rest
LeBlanc. Day. Jean-Marie LeBlanc would be staring in total disbelief at this route, wouldn't he?
Oh, he totally would be. But I remember Jean-François Pecheur, who at the time was basically made the race. He was the director of the race, let's say. Yeah. And who that role is now filled by Thierry Gouvenou.
Yeah.
And so I remember, because I know Jean-François Pecheur quite well, and he said his dream had always been to have a whole Tour de France without a summit finish.
Yeah.
Because he thought that would make the racing much more animated. And yeah. I think with Christian Prudhomme's direction at a kind of a pure management level, and with Thierry Gouvenou has almost been given, it's like the ghost of Jean-François Pecheur is coming through in making this route as absolutely erratic as possible and complicated to race as they can. And so far, we're on stage 11 now, the second flat day in a row after the rest day, and up to now, everything's been a madness.
Yeah, it feels like a load of one-day races tacked together, which is mouth-watering if that's how it's going to be raced. Then on stage 12, the 9th of July, don't forget the race starts a week early this year, next year as well, because of the Olympic Games, which is another factor. But stage 12 is the only stage over 200 kilometres, and that's good. I mean, they could have been perhaps even braver. A lot of them are pretty close to 200 kilometres in length, but that's interesting. I mean, that's the only one that is over 200 kilometres. And then on stage 13...
Again, sorry, I'm just going to interrupt there briefly, Ned, because it's in the Corrèze. Which is, again, it's an incredibly hilly region.
Oh, is that a nasty one, is it?
That's a nasty. As an amateur in 1995, I won the Tour de la Corrèze, and it was an absolute bastard of a race. And so it's sort of on the cusp, it's on the edge of this. It could essentially be classified Massif Central as well. So that's not going to be it's going to be a very hard 218 kilometres.
And the final day, the next day, finishes on the top of Puy-Marie, which is the defining climb of that part of France, of the Massif Central, the northern sector. And it's pretty close to the home turf of a certain Julien Alaphilippe. And these things are not coincidental. We went to Romain Bardet's hometown last year. We are skirting Alaphilippe territory here. And that's happened for a reason. He's earned his right for the race to come past his front door.
And also, let's not forget that up to this point, we're now on we're at stage 13, and there hasn't been a time trial yet.
Yeah, well, you have to wait till stage 20 for the only time trial. So that's really unusual as well. So then pretty soon, we're in the Jura and the Alps again. There's a summit finish on stage 15 to Grand Colombier, which is very long. It's not particularly, from my memory though, David, the Colombier is long but relatively shallow, you know, so it's a grind, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. It's what we might call a power climb.
It's not reputed
to being kind of hyper difficult, complicated, but it all the same depends how the race goes into it. But yeah, it's not a scary climb, although it can make differences.
Yeah. And then the remaining summit finish before La Planche des Belles Filles is completely unknown to the Tour de France. It's in Méribel. It's called the Col de la Loz. And the reason it's unknown is because the road itself is only 3 months old. It's a completely new road. And by all accounts, I mean, no one knows it. No one will have done any reconnaissance on it yet. By all accounts, the final 3-4 kilometres are ludicrously not just steep, but they are a constant change in the gradient. So it's like a kind of, you know, set to shuffle, basically. So very, very hard race to know. And certainly one, you know, almost the first one that the well-funded and well-organised teams will go to, I think, to do their reconnaissance, because that will be a big unknown for them, I think.
Yeah, very much. And by the sounds of it, it's one of those classic sort of mountain paths that's been just recently tarmacked. Because they're saying in the final 7 kilometres, there's numerous passages at 20%. So it's almost like it just goes straight up something. So yeah, as you say, that I think we can count on everybody. No one's going to be surprised by it. If they are, then they've made a terrible mistake, because you're going to have to go and recon that and get to know it. And that's going to be one of those climbs where the race will be defined.
And then we will come down to stage 20, La Planche des Belles Filles, and the individual time trial. It's not just from the bottom, so it's longer than just the whatever it is, 6 kilometres of La Planche des Belles Filles. It's 36K in length, so there's a 30-kilometre preamble to get to the foot of the climb. And I really like individual time, you know what my opinion sometimes of time trialing is like, but I like individual time trials that have that structure, so that for the riders who will lose a bit of time on the climb but are very strong on the flat, there is an opportunity, you know, a 30-kilometre opportunity for them to take time that they then might lose a little bit on the, you know, on the sting at the end of the tail. So it's got a dynamic and a narrative within it that sometimes time trialling lacks, and I like the sound of it in every regard.
I think as well, Ned, we need to do our own time trial up there again.
No, I don't. I really don't. We've discussed this, David. It's simply not happening. You know,
for those listeners that aren't aware of this, this year was Ned Bolton's 50th birthday, and as a birthday present, we organised a time trial up La Planche des Belles Filles, because the Tour de France went up this year. Only we did it on foot, and we handicapped it on age, and it was Ned Bolton set off first, me 8 minutes later, and then a little pretty Pete Kenyuk went 12 minutes after me, and he won.
But he was the fastest up there.
There were no catches, that was a. And you know, that's it's interesting they're going twice up there. As you say, it's going to make for a very interesting time trial, because those first 28 kilometres to get to the foot, 30 kilometres, they're not easy either. It's rolling, but that would be normally where the climber's on the back foot on that terrain. But let's face it, most GC contenders these days can time trial. So it's going to come down to who's recovered best, who's freshest, because I think by this point in the race, we're not going to see a time trial specialist in the GC race. It's going to be all of those GC contenders, the Roglic, Chris Froome, let's say Geraint Thomas, Egan Bernal. If those are the riders that are up there fighting for the overall, they're all very equally matched in the time trial. So it's going to make for a spectacular race.
Just a bit. It's mouthwatering. And obviously, we know that Primoz Roglic will win the race. That's been defined. But he will have some competition. You know, how would it be if Pogacar goes to the Tour de France?
Ooh,
I think it's unlikely,
Pogacar.
But that would be great to witness, wouldn't it?
It'd be amazing.
And then we go to Paris. And the only thing, you know, Paris is Paris, obviously. But the only thing worth saying about Paris is, and this is rather disappointing, is that La Course, having left Paris to make itself slightly more interesting, has returned to Paris to make itself slightly more boring, which is a real shame, because the last couple of, you know, La Course is a dog's dinner, really. But despite despite ASO not knowing what to do with it, actually, the way that the racers have attacked it over the last couple of years has been really interesting, and I've really enjoyed watching and commentating on it. But I'm you know, less thrilled at the idea of a criterium in Paris again for the women. Now, just to put that in context, from what I understand, just from reading Richard Moore's postings today, our colleague, I think there is a move afoot, and maybe an announcement imminent, that ASO actually are on the brink, on the cusp of getting a independent women's stage race up and running. So that might have something to do with the fact that they have kind of like drawn their horns in a little bit with regard to La Course this year. So I hope that's the case. But there we go. That's Paris. So that's it. That's the Tour de France. Have we got any other business? Yeah, go on.
No, but I'm just going to wrap up that as well. It does seem, and I can't imagine, because these things are so complicated to put together, but this is a perfect course for Julian Alaphilippe, for Thibaut Pinot, for those two French riders in particular. I mean, it's going to make for such an anarchic race. I mean, this year we saw, and now looking back at 2019's edition, we thought that was an interesting course. It's almost like they've taken that and decided, well, let's just amp it up. Let's turn it to 11 and make it the most interesting Tour de France that's ever been raced. I don't really have words for it. I've never seen anything like this, and it's going to be fabulous viewing.
But David, you're absolutely right, aren't you? This is the shape that it's taken, the form that it's taken has been. I mean, these races don't, you know, they haven't been planning it since July. A lot of this will have been, the bricks would have been put in place a long way out, years ahead, you know, Nice, for example. But its final shape, I think, has been very much dictated by what happened on the Tour de France last year with Pinot, as you say, and Alaphilippe. Because, I don't know, it's quite possible that they've actually taken out a longer individual time trial that was originally planned for. That would be really interesting to know, wouldn't it? Whether or not they've taken a dramatic step behind the scenes to actually get one or other of these riders over the line for France.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing that could have been done. But at the same time, this route will have been mainly mapped out last year before this year's tour, because you have to get buy-in, because obviously towns, and the majority of towns will have to pay for this. Obviously, they'll subsidise certain smaller places or regions will do it. There's a lot of logistical and political wrangling to get a Tour de France stage, and then they have to link it all up and make the route. And especially in the modern world, going back to Jean-François Pechaud and Jean-Marie Leblanc, who you mentioned, Jean-François Pechaud used to tell me stories. He told me stories about, he used to map out the route. Him and Jean-Marie Leblanc would go on a road trip in October or November. This is like a year and a half before, and sometimes they're already sensing it for 2 years ahead, a road trip around France for 3 weeks and sort of mapping out, coming up with their route. And they'd literally turn up to the mairie, the town hall, and knock on the door and trying to find out where the mayor lived or meet the mayor. And then they'd end up having lunch, dinner, and going around places like that in these smaller places. And obviously the big cities, it was all very organized. But back in the day, it used to end up just being on long lunches and dinners, mapping out the route, going around France. Now, amazing, those days are gone. It's a huge operation. And I think, as you said, serendipity has allowed, the stars have aligned in many ways, that this route that was already mapped out before the success of Alaphilippe this year and Thibaut Pinot is actually perfect for them.
And one thing has been cleared up by that. And, you know, we were wondering, on air and in various different events we've done, what Alaphilippe's next move would be in terms of how he sees his career progressing. And that slight doubt about whether or not he would want to commit to being a GC racer again at the Tour de France. Well, that's cleared up. There's no more muddied thinking, I don't think, for him. It's very clear, isn't it, that he's got to try and get himself on the podium here. Or try.
I agree. I agree completely. I think this is I say once in a lifetime. It's obviously second in a lifetime chance, because this year went pretty well. But he's got no excuses. It would be an absolute folly for him not to turn up to Tour de France next year with intentions, with big ambitions, because this is not to be sniffed at, as they say.
Brilliant. All right. Very nice to speak to you, David. I have got so many other business. I know that you, in particular, will be tuning into the back end of this podcast with bated breath, because after a little bit of music, I'm going to play you a recording I made back in Harrogate with a doyen of the podcasting world, Lionel Burney, where we indulged our mutual admiration for the ladies and gentlemen of the Oki, the darters of the world. Stay put. So we're in the Harrogate Arms, which you very quickly ascertained, Lionel, and I thought it was a brilliant bit of research, actually. You know, early doors during the World Championships had a darts board.
Not just one dart board, Ned, two dart boards. So it's quite a pro setup there. You can warm up on one board and then move across to the match board for our big showdown, which we've... Are you going to tell your listeners how you got on in our game?
Well, I will, actually, because it didn't end in total ignominy. I went to pieces. I mean, I am a hopeless darts player, but I can at least hit the board. However, at the beginning, I couldn't. So it was two teams, wasn't it? You were paired with Renard Schotte, who is Mr. Cycling in Sporza in Belgium, the esteemed cycling commentator, watched on by José Calvas, who used to be in charge of Belgian cycling, didn't he?
More than that, he was Greg LeMond's director sportif in the 1989 Tour de France, which Greg LeMond won by 8 seconds. And the great story about De Cauwer is that he was in the team car behind LeMond on Alpe d'Huez, and just behind De Kauer's team car was Cyril Guimard, the sports director, director sportif of Laurent Fignon, Le Mans' great rival in that tour. And Guimard knew from having worked with Le Mans for so long before the tells of when Le Mans was struggling, sort of rocking in the saddle, shoulders going a bit. And he wanted to get up past De Kauer's team car to tell Le Mans, to tell Fignon to attack. So De Kauer was weaving all across the road and taking the corners on Alpe d'Huez as wide as he possibly could
to block him.
To block him, because there was no radios in those days, so there was no way of getting the message up to Fignon to attack, attack, attack. So De Kauer possibly helped Le Mans win the Tour de France in 89. I mean, he was significant.
One of his significant sporting achievements, the other one was watching us play darts today. It's his birthday, actually, Jose. So. Do you say Jose or Jose? I never quite know with him, so I hedge my bets a bit. But anyway, that's neither here nor there, because this is about darts, really, isn't it, in the podcast that never strays far from cycling. This is about darts. And you and I share an enthusiasm. I'd hesitate to call it a passion, but it's a genuine enthusiasm for darts, don't we? I was going to say you're half decent, but you're not. In the grand scheme of things, you're not even an eighth decent, really. But I'm off the scale. So you can throw a dart, I can't, but we both like watching it, don't we?
I love darts. I've got a dartboard in my office at home. I play when I should be working. You know, it's a great sort of therapeutic pursuit when I'm trying to write or when, you know, something else should be happening. I can throw a few darts. It's a bit like my cycling. I look okay.
You've got poise and you've got a proper action. Yeah,
I'm a fraud, really. I copy the action of the best players on the TV, but the dart doesn't go in the segments that I require. A bit like cycling, I look okay on a bike, I would say, but I'm slow and not very good at cycling. But if you saw a little clip of me on a bike, you'd go, "Oh, yeah, he can cycle and looks okay." I kind of know the theory behind what looks okay and what you should look like, but I have no kind of power beyond the poise. And it's the same with darts, really. I can throw the dart at the board in a, you know, I've got the stance right down to a tee, but then when you cut, if the camera were then to cut to the board and look at where they go, that's where it all falls down, really. A great metaphor for almost every aspect of my life.
But I'm not making it up. I do genuinely love darts. And I ascertained quite early online on that, on the face of it, there are no sports more separated than darts and cycling, right? Physiologically, one is played out over, what is an hockey again? It's 7 foot nine and a quarter inches or something like that?
Quarter
inches. Yeah. And another one is played out over 285 kilometres.
Yeah.
Right? And that's not the only difference. There are many other. So if you lined up sporting endeavour, cycling would be at one end, darts would be firmly at the other end of the spectrum. But here's the thing. And it took me a while when I was writing a book about darts to actually establish this in my mind. They are almost the only sports that British youth or British middle age or British people have all done. We have all ridden a bike.
And we've all thrown a dart.
And we've all thrown a dart.
Yeah.
How many times have you javelined?
Well, at school I had a go at a javelin, yeah. But
hockeyed?
I played hockey, yeah.
Synchronised swum?
No.
Equestrianed?
No.
Canoeing?
Yes. What are we doing here?
We could carry on. But you take my point. They're incredibly democratic things, like, and they are somehow linked to our everyday lives, both of them. Do you see what I'm getting at?
I do, actually. I think there's something about the we're in a pub, obviously. There's something about these pub sports and British culture that really appeals to me. Everyone plays a game of pool as well. That's another one. Back in the day, you know, there'd be a shove halfpenny table in a pub, you know, and you'd feel compelled to have a go. And I think that's the thing with darts. When you see a dartboard in a pub, no matter how terrible you are, you feel kind of compelled to go and ask at the bar, "Oh, have you got the set of darts?" And then they hand them over, and there's, like, you know, one that's got a sort of plastic stem on it, and one that's not, doesn't tighten up properly, and all the flights are different, and they're different weights, and you don't, you kind of, none of that really matters. Yeah. And I think there's something about sort of your first steps in cycling, you know, just getting on any bike and just having a go when you're a kid. That is a kind of universally shared experience, I think. So I get where you're coming from there. But, I mean, drinking heavily and darts go together. Drinking heavily and cycling do not go together, listeners. Let's just be careful and clear about that.
That's very true. I've dreamt of, and I'm not taking the mic here. I've designed a darts cycling duathlon, right? In quite intimate detail, actually. And I tried to convince. Do you remember the long lost and lamented Revolution series, which sadly is no longer with us? James Pope, who used to run that from the mm-hmm. FACE partnership, mm-hmm. he said, "I'm all for innovation, Ned. Have you got any new ideas?" And I said, "Darts, cycling, duathlon." And it works like this. It's a relay. Because I think, listen, I think relays basically are underused and underutilised in cycling, full stop. I think it's a whole untapped mine of great racing that we could have. But so the darts one works like this. You have a team of darters. Mm-hmm. Chris Mason would be my first name on the team sheet. So a lot of podcast listeners won't know who Chris Mason is, but you're nodding sagely because you know about Chris Mason. His prison sentence was short.
Yeah,
but he's a good man. He's an amazing guy, and he's recently embraced cycling. Anyway, so you have a team of darters, right? Let's say four darters and four proper cyclists, right? I'm talking about Ed Clancy, that sort of guy, right? Four cyclists, and one after the other. So rider one goes on each team. They have to do a lap of the velodrome, okay? Mm-hmm. Or maybe two. They have to get off. And they have to rush to the track centre, mm-hmm. and they have to throw. I think it would be ridiculous to ask them to throw a bullseye or a treble 20 because that might take forever. But they just have to throw a 20, all right?
Okay.
Okay. To release the next rider. Okay.
Okay.
And off they go. So you get the cyclist smashing and taking chunks of time on the darters, presumably. Mm-hmm. But mate, when their heart rate is going 10 to the dozen, and I reckon they'd miss the board, quite frankly. And it'd be really interesting to see how the darters performed under those circumstances. Because hitting a 20 for a darter, I'm not exaggerating, they can literally do it with their eyes shut.
In my office at home, I have my turbo trainer set up with my bike on it in front of the dartboard, and I have played darts whilst riding on the turbo. And my idea for the duathlon is that your score, there's some kind of percentage sliding scale of score depending on your heart rate. So
nice.
The more your heart rate goes up, the more the score is multiplied. So if you're riding at 165 beats a minute, we're sort of pretty up there, but not at your maximum. And then you hit a treble 20. You know, there's some coefficient. It's not a great spectator sport because it's going to be very complicated. But it will tax the boffins. But there'll be a whole. It'll be like the Cycling Weekly gear. You know, the gear table when how many inches your 5311 is. that will have to be distributed, and for the spectators, it will be complicated. But the idea is
that
your
turbo
training.
Might take a few years to bed in as well, that coefficient, until you've got it absolutely finely calibrated.
Ned, you know TV people, we can get a deal for this. We could get this on Dave, I'm sure. Turbo training and darts.
Topless. Might have to be topless, but
no one wanted to see that.
The only thing that slightly worries me about this great idea, in fact my idea as well, but yours especially, is I don't want to death on the track. I don't want to death, and there may be a death.
I mean,
live.
The physique of the top darts players. I mean, it requires equivalent work to the physique of the top cyclists, but just in the opposite direction, doesn't it?
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, there have, from time to time, there have been athletes who have graced the hockey. You know, one thinks of the Cristiano Ronaldo of darts of a decade ago, Jelle Klaassen, who won the BDO World Championship, who was famously teetotal and young and incredibly good-looking. Drinks a bit now, I have to say. But it's very hard, actually, to... here's another thing that amazed me about darts when I started working in it, Lionel, is... I remember one of my first Grand Slam of darts in the Wolverhampton Civic that I covered. I was just wandering around backstage
one evening, and there was a knock on the stage door, and I was kind of walking between my presentation position and the interview room, and I opened this, and this chap with a briefcase and wearing a suit turned up, and he said, "I'm here from UK Sport to do the anti-doping."
Whoa. Wow. They did anti-doping at that.
They get funding from UK Sports. They are officially recognised as a sport, which is entirely appropriate because that's a separate debate. It is a sport. Mm. It is undeniably a sport. But there are certain things. So they, by being in that, they have to submit to anti-doping programmes. But they can untick certain substances.
Right.
And so, you know, alcohol was one that, in particular, that they unticked. But the real difference between doping in cycling and doping in darts is that the anti-doping officers have no trouble collecting a sample.
No,
it's like, how much do you want, mate?
Yeah,
is it 3 litres?
So guy comes along with a watering can to take away Adrian Lewis's urine sample for testing. That's really interesting. I actually didn't know that, because I've always wondered, you know, sports which rely on a great deal of hand-eye coordination and also calmness under pressure would be rife for some kind of, you know, beta blocker.
Yeah, but, well, beta blocker is actually in all seriousness, beta blocker is the dope. I mean, I don't know how. What, I don't think a darts player's ever tested positive for it. I don't think. I might be wrong, but that would be the one, because that's used in, what's that Winter Olympics thing?
The biathlon.
The modern is it whatever that one? The shooty runny, the ski shooty thing.
That's the model for our cycling darts duathlon, isn't
correct.
It? Because they're working very hard, and then they have to be very focused to hit their target.
Yeah.
Same thing. Why not? I mean, and it would be perfect for the Winter Olympics, indoor cycling and darts. I just don't see why, you know, why it's not happened yet. And yeah. I think you're the man to put a lot of pressure on the broadcasters, the governing bodies, get everyone round the
governing
table.
Bodies.
Get everyone
the UCI
round the table.
Meets the PDC. Yeah. Barry Hearn.
Barry Hearn and David Lepartion have a...
They'll go that is literally the funniest thing I've
they'll go for pie and mash somewhere.
And imagine if Barry Hearn bought cycling. He's bought darts, he's bought snooker.
I'll have the Tour de France, mate.
What would be the first thing Barry would do?
Well, walk on girls.
Oh, no. The podium girls would be back, wouldn't they?
They'd be completely back. Yeah. They'd be completely back. Yeah.
Maybe this isn't a great idea then.
No, it'll be an absolute pleasure. It wasn't a pleasure playing against you because you whooped our collective backsides. Mainly due, I have to say, to the Belgian Renard. I mean, he's got it all.
I mean, we need to come up with a nickname for him. Renard. Yeah. What are we going to call? Where's he from in Belgium? We need to find that out and then come up with.
Yeah.
The.
But then he overstepped his mark. He said, "You know, Belgians like the best in darts. We are the worst."
No, mate.
You've got Ronnie and Kim Huybrechts, and that's it.
Yeah.
All right.
No, the Dutch next door.
They're the
second best.
I was telling you, I was working on the women's tour with Marianne Vos a few years ago as my pundit, and we were travelling around together in the same car, and you know what it's like travelling around on a stage race, just chatting away about stuff. And she said to me, do you cover other sports? And I said, yeah, darts. And she said, I've done some events. I don't want to do a Dutch accent, it's a bit patronising, isn't it? But anyway, she said, I've done a lot of events with, we have a very famous Dutch darts player, don't we? And I do some television things with him. I said, Michael van Gerwen.
Wow.
And she said, yeah, wow. And she said, the guy who looks like a big baby.
Yes, yes.
And I went, yes, that's Michael van Gerwen. That's Michael van Gerwen, the most talented darts player who's ever lived, really. And anyway, she said, it's not really a sport. And I gave her my whole spiel that I won't bore you with about, yes, it absolutely is. And she went, okay, well maybe I'm convinced, because she's a lovely, open-minded person. So when we finished working together, I thought, I know what I'm going to do. It's a nice little gesture to thank her for the week's work. I'm going to buy her some special Marianne Vos flights.
Oh, nice.
Right? So you can get them bespoke. So yeah. I did that. It only cost me a tenner. It wasn't a big gesture. Mm. And then I thought, well, it's a bit ridiculous unless she's got some darts to put them in, right? Mm. So I bought some quite expensive unicorn darts, right, to go with them, you know. And then I thought, she hasn't got a darts board, has she?
So you bought a dartboard?
So I thought, I better get a dartboard. And then I thought, I've got to post this all off to the Netherlands. And by now, just to buy the kit, I was about 50 quid down, right? And then I had to post it, and the postage cost 70 quid.
No.
It was a flippant throwaway comment, and it cost me 120 quid. And I can bet that that dartboard is just sitting in the corner of Marianne Vos's house and has never been used.
And well, no, and you spent 250,000 euros on the Marianne Vos sport hall, which has got dartboards all lined up in it for her to play in her hometown. That's the next step, isn't it?
I thought
you were going to say that she would suddenly reveal that she'd reached the last eight in the women's Dutch Open darts.
You know she would. You know that if she did that, she'd be right there. It might be a future career. All right, listen, sup up. You've got a pint in the hand, and we've both got things to do. But that was that will have alienated almost every of our embryonic podcast, and we are just a small little thing compared to your monolithic project. But yeah, what few listeners we had, Lionel, we've just thrown them away.
Well, they wouldn't have been expecting 15 minutes of dark chat, would they? So, well, I mean, give people what they don't know they want.
Correct. We've done it with astrophysics, and now we're doing it with darts. Enjoyed that edition of The Roadbook, the cycling podcast that never strays far from darts. Incidentally, The Roadbook itself will be published on November the 1st, the 2019 edition. You can go to the website, theroadbook.co.uk, and take advantage of the special offers involving the 2018 edition as well to complete your collection.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.